There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
We stranded him much in the manner of the Bond and Alex Rider villains he writes so well. Except we left him with three books to keep him company, so we're not as bad as Scaramanga, are we, Rachel?
We certainly aren't.
Just to remind you how prolific he is, here's a bit of background on Anthony Horowitz.
Anthony Horowitz is one of the most prolific and successful writers working in the UK, juggling writing over 40 books, creating and writing beloved TV series, films, plays, and journalism. Horowitz's bestsellers include the teen spy series Alex Rider. The latest book in the series, Never Say Die, was published last year and will be followed by a short story collection. A TV adaptation is also in the works. Horowitz is also an acclaimed writer for adults. He was commissioned by the Conan Doyle Estate to write two new Sherlock Holmes novels and by the Ian Fleming Estate to write a new James Bond novel. The sequel will be published this spring. In 2014, he was awarded an OBE for his services to literature.
So there you go, a little bit about Anthony Horowitz, who is attending the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature. Remember, you can get tickets from emiratelitfest.com. The festival is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March. Not many sleeps away now.
I know, and talk about a VIP castaway. The whole world will be in trauma. I think they'd send someone out to find him.
I had to refrain from fangirling too hard, I have to say, ahead of time. But we're now going to transport you to the island, where I've just asked Anthony what the first book he's brought with him is.
Well, I had to think about this very carefully, because if I'm stuck on a desert island and therefore I'm going to be there for a very long time, I want a book which I can read and reread and revisit, and not something which I will finish in a week and then have nothing to do with, except maybe use to light a fire. So the first book I've chosen is a very long book which I've read two or three times in my life, and it's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, a work of non-fiction by William Shearer.
When I first got in touch with you about some of the castaway choices, you were pretty flexible on some of the other books, which we won't spoil for the listeners just yet. But this is the one there was absolutely no leeway on. Like, there was no doubt in your mind that you would be taking this. Why is it so close to your heart?
Well, I think for two reasons. First of all, it's brilliantly written. Shearer was actually a correspondent in Berlin at the time of the rise of the Third Reich and reported from Berlin. He was even at Compiègne and saw the signing of the armistice. So he was very much a witness on the ground. He's a brilliant writer. But I think the reason why this book is so important to me is that it is the most significant event. I mean, the Second World War broadly has been a huge influence on my life. Every aspect of it. Foyle's War, obviously my television program, covered the period 1940 all the way through to 1947. I grew up, I was born in 1955, which is 10 years after the war, but nonetheless I grew up with the shadow of that war still over me. And as a Jew, it's also of huge significance to me, particularly at a time when I'm seeing anti-Semitism spike all over Europe. This is, of course, of great concern to me. And this book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, has huge, significant lessons for the times we live in. I make no comparisons between now and then. I always think that it is a futile exercise to try and compare anything to the rise of Nazism. But nonetheless, if you look at what's happened in Germany from about sort of 1930 onwards, this journey into the abyss is something that we have to learn from. We have to revisit, we have to read about, we have to understand to prevent anything even remotely similar ever happening again.
You mentioned Foyle's War earlier, and you spent, was it 16 years of your life working on that?
That's right, yes.
So much like Shearer, you're no stranger to intensive projects, and you mentioned that you found it useful when working on Foyle's War. Was it useful in general to give you a wider idea of the scope of the war? Or was there anything particular that you remember being useful to an episode in the series?
Well, certainly not out of this book. The William Shearer book doesn't really deal with events in Britain anyway, on the home front. Or it is very much focused on the war from the German perspective, if you like. So I didn't use this book. There were books by someone, Norman Longmate, Angus Calder, two of the great social historians of the period, with the books that I used for Foyle's War. What this book, the Shearer book, gave me, if you like, was the urgency to tell the story, you know, even in Foyle's War, in a way that was relevant to today. You know, when I sat down with the cast on the very first episode of Foyle's War, I remember making a short speech to the extent that the Second World War is not yet history, because there are still people alive who fought in it. I have myself met survivors of the camps and such. I have visited Auschwitz and such. And I am very aware of the fact that we are still very much in the shadow of the war, even all these years later. So if you like, what the rise and fall of the Third Reich gave me was sort of a sense of urgency, of doing a good, of the need to do a good job.
I have to say, I was surprised when you sent your list through, because I don't know, I just assumed that you would be taking the complete collection of Sherlock Holmes stories for your desert island. In my head, I had that, my mind was made up. And you surprised me.
I have taken your challenge very seriously, because as I've said, it isn't just, you know, if you said to me, which are your three favourite books, take your three favourite books to, you know, on holiday with you, then of course it would have been, you know, Charles Dickens, it would have been Ian Fleming, it would have been Conan Doyle, Anthony Trollope, Jane Austen. You know, these are the books which I love, but I'm thinking to myself that I'm sitting here on the sand for maybe months, if not years, and these are the books that I have chosen are books that I can look at day after day after day and get something new from every time. Now, to an extent, incidentally, that is true of Dickens. I have read Dickens' works probably three or four times over the course of my life, and what is great about them, I think it is, if you like, a definition of great literature, is that every time I read them, I find something new in them. I find them reflecting something in me that wasn't there before. But on your island, where there are only three books and there is nothing else to do, Shearer's book does go into extraordinary detail about the people, you know, these remarkable people who came together to create this sort of terrible period in modern history. And the wealth of detail, the accumulation of detail, makes it a book which you really can read and reread every time with fresh rewards.
That was Anthony Horowitz with his first Castaway book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shearer, which, incidentally, my grandfather highly recommends.
That's important.
I forgot to ask him about ration books. He told me this really interesting thing years ago about how, because he was about 10 years old during the Second World War, and or when it ended, and he remembered one particular thing, that he didn't see bananas until he was 10 or something, and that there were all these different coloured ration books for different people. I must ask him about that and bring it up on a show another time. But basically, I did some research on desert islands and Bond, because I was thinking, I know Scaramanga's Island, I wonder if there were actually any other desert islands involved in the Bond series in film form or in book form. The only one I could immediately think of was Scaramanga's, but when you do research, the abandoned island in Skyfall comes up a lot.
Yeah, see, I wouldn't have thought of that automatically.
Neither would
I'm also Scaramanga.
Yeah.
Also, were they on an island? You know when he had to climb over all the crocodiles? Where was that to get?
I don't remember.
It was something with a moat. But it may have been a very small island.
See, the other thing I realised as I was doing this research was, because I couldn't remember which one that Scaramanga's island was in, and it's the man with the golden gun.
Yeah.
I get all the gold ones mixed up. So I mix up Goldeneye and Goldfinger and the man with the golden gun.
There are
gun.
A lot of Bond films, to be fair.
Maybe they could go with bronze another time, you know?
Yeah.
A different material. Maybe platinum.
Yeah,
branch out a bit. So, yeah, the island in Skyfall is an abandoned island, commonly called Gukanjima, which I've probably pronounced horribly wrong. Hashima Island is an abandoned island in Nagasaki in Japan, or just off the coast of Nagasaki. When coal mining declined, operations at the facility ceased and the island was deserted.
Very interesting.
It's just a random fact.
It's a very random fact, but I like it.
And also, I wanted to share one of my favourite quotes from Anthony Horowitz's The House of Silk, which is one of the Sherlock Holmes novels that he wrote. I've read Moriarty, I've not read The House of Silk, but I just thought, I wanted to give you a feel of just how brilliant he is at echoing such a well-known voice, because that's not easy to do, because he has to write in sort of in the style of Conan
yes.
Doyle for the Conan Doyle estate. And this is a quote from The House of Silk. Show Holmes a drop of water and he would deduce the existence of the Atlantic. Show it to me and I would look for a tap. That was the difference between us. And I just thought that was the most beautiful, succinct way of describing the difference between Sherlock Holmes and Watson.
Nice, very nice. He has a real skill for that. I don't know if you were at, there was a literature festival event where there was a quiz and Anthony Horowitz wrote one section of the quiz and everyone had to guess which era the story came from.
I was at that.
Yes, and you had to guess the author and you had to guess the time period. And we were all there, we were trying really hard to get
and
it.
He tricked
People
us
were
all.
Convinced that they knew the answer, that they'd read the book, and it was all a trick. And he had made up all of these quotes, but he's so clever at mimicking other people's voices that everybody in the room fell for it, and there were newsreaders, authors, all sorts of wise people in the room. Everyone fell for it. It was brilliant,
including the not wise people, obviously.
Yeah,
like me.
Yeah, I did too, but yeah, no, it was a fantastic thing. And I just think that is a skill, and I talk about that a lot when I do school visits, about how if kids try and copy their favorite writers when they're young, it definitely helps you find your own voice and your own style later.
Well, speaking of Anthony Horowitz events, he is coming to the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in March, which is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March. And if you go to emiratelitfest.com, you can find out more information about everything that we're talking about today. But just to give you a heads up about the two events that I really want to highlight, he's talking about the Alex Rider series, because he's written a new one, which everybody didn't expect.
We love those books.
It's called Never Say Die, and the title of the session is called Alex Rider Returns, and it's happening on Saturday, the 3rd of March. By the way, I accidentally, when I was writing this up, I actually wrote Alid Rider, and hilariously I wondered what a Welsh version of a spy would look like and sound like.
Be interesting.
That kept me occupied for a few minutes, actually. So yeah, Never Say Die is the latest Alex Rider book, and he'll be talking about that and hints of what to expect in Alex's next adventure, Nightshade. And then on Friday the 2nd of March, the day before, there's something for the grown-ups. So The Word is Murder, I'm reading this and it's great. That is a crime novel that he's written with himself as one of the characters. And if you read about it, you think there's no way you can make this work. But Anthony manages to do it because he's brilliant.
He can do anything.
So in the book, The Word is Murder, he's busy working on his first Sherlock Holmes novel. And he agrees to play Watson to Detective Daniel Hawthorne. They will solve a bizarre murder, write a book about it, and split the profits. What could go wrong?
Gosh, that's interesting. I don't know that. I'm going to have to get hold of that. I might borrow your version.
So do check that out. And he's in conversation with Kate Moss, which was our previous Castaway guest. So it's kind of, you know, those actors on actors things that you see online?
Yeah.
We're doing a similar thing at the festival this year. We're having a few writers
authors
on writers.
Authors. Yeah, I like
exactly.
It.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Emirates Airline Festival of Literature author Anthony Horowitz is one of the most prolific and successful writers working in the UK. He juggles writing over 40 books, creating and writing beloved TV series like Foyle's War, films, plays and journalism. There is nothing that he can't do, I think.
I would agree.
I haven't seen him write any poetry, though, to be fair.
No, I don't think there were any in that thing. I bet he could, though.
I bet he could.
He could do anything.
He's told us about the first book he'd take to his desert island, which was The Rise and the Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. And we're now moving on to something similarly epic. I asked him to tell me more.
Well, your listeners are going to be a little bit shocked, perhaps, to hear that the second book is a book which I haven't actually read. I've chosen a book which I haven't read because, again, given your parameters, here I am stuck on a desert island. I want a book which I have never read and which I will be forced to read because I've only got three books and I'm there for a very long time.
You sound a bit bitter,
so
Anthony.
I say, blushingly, and with my sort of, you know, with my sort of heart in my mouth, as it were, that the second book I have chosen is Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. This monumental book, often considered to be the greatest piece of work in literature, in all literature perhaps, is a book which I have tried to read two or three times, and here I am in my 60s now, and I'm afraid I have never managed to get through it. Isn't that an awful admission to make on your radio program? But it is the truth.
It's not an awful admission because it's honest, and it's something that a lot of listeners and readers share. We've all got that one book that we've picked up multiple times and not actually managed to get through. So it's actually quite refreshing to hear an author such as yourself admit to something like that. Do you feel guilty about not having read it?
It's a very interesting question. It was one thing I wanted to discuss with you, because I think that, you know, we all have a limited amount of time, both in our work and how busy we are in the day, and also in our life. You know, often now I will pick up a book and I will think to myself, a Dickens, for example, that this is probably the last time I will read this book. And it's sort of very sad. And at the same time, yes, there are great works of fiction that we all know, but which often we have not actually read for many reasons. Now, in the case of War and Peace, there are two reasons why I've never managed to get through it. The first is that I find it very difficult to read books in translation. I'm always aware that if you read a book in translation, you are one step away from the author's original intentions. And given the fact that there are tens of thousands of great books in the English language, it seems almost, I don't know, it feels, I wouldn't say a waste of time, because that's quite wrong, but what it does feel is it feels unnecessary, it feels secondary, it feels somehow strange to be inflicting a second language upon myself. So that's one of the reasons why I haven't read it, and it's not a good reason, incidentally, but it's just the honest reason. The second thing is that it has, War and Peace, so many characters with, you know, names that sort of don't really fall off the tongue for me as an English person. You know, the Bolkonskis, the Kuragins, the Rostovs, etc., etc., etc. By the time I get to around about page 100, 150, all these names are at war in my head, and I'm thumbing back to try and find out who they all are, and I can never quite get over the hump into the sort of the second part of the book, which I think is perhaps, you know, the book, the part which I would enjoy more, when you leave the parties in Russia and move to the war. So those are the sort of two main reasons I haven't read it. Now, 19th century literature is what I most love. I've talked about Dickens. Great Expectations was written, my favorite book incidentally of all time, Great Expectations, was written 1 year before War and Peace. And it makes me think that by not reading War and Peace, I am not doing justice to Dickens, because he is part of a sort of a, you know, of a culture, of a literary movement at the time. These were the great books being produced. And really, for the sake of my own knowledge and for the sake of my own sort of cultural awareness, I should be reading them all. So the short answer to your question, do I feel guilty? Yes.
It's funny that you actually brought this up, because we were actually talking about this on the show last week. Reading books that are perceived to be difficult, the arguments for persevering with them versus giving up on a book if you're not enjoying it, classic or not. But whenever the question of this, what we choose to read or not read, comes up, I always think of that Oscar Wilde quote, "It is what you read when you don't have to that determines what you will be when you can't help it."
Well, that's a wonderful quote, but I will say this. As an author for young people, and knowing that the, you know, that literacy and the love of literature and of reading good books is something which is ever more limited these days, because people are busy, because there are computers, because there are so many other distractions, and because of the world we live in, where literacy has to fight for its sort of place. I have never argued that you should read a book that you are not enjoying simply because you've got to get to the bitter end. Much, much better to stop a book halfway and move on to a book that you do enjoy and that you consider valuable. I do not prescribe to the idea that reading is necessarily, in inverted commas, good for you. Yes, of course, reading is wonderful, but it's not good for you in the way of vitamins or medicine or healthy food. It is something much deeper and more profound than that, and therefore, I think that the act of reading, that moment when you click with a book, whether it is Tolstoy or, for heaven's sake, Dan Brown, is important and matters, and you should go with what you enjoy.
That seems a practical approach, considering what you mentioned earlier about there's only so many books that you can read in a lifetime. And actually, if you read a book a month for 60 years, that would mean you have read about 720 books in a lifetime. So you have to make these choices quite carefully. So what are your criteria when you choose a new book for yourself?
Well, I am interested in great literature. I mean, I think there is a discernible difference in the experience of reading. I mentioned Dan Brown or Tolstoy, so I'll say Dan Brown or Dickens. I think that great literature has greater reward. That doesn't, however, describe the work of a Dan Brown. I love Stephen King. I love Harlan Coben. I mean, you know, I like Agatha Christie, for heaven's sake. You know, there are many different ways, and there are many different types of reading for pleasure. But for me, put it this way, I see reading as being an adventure, a journey. And for me, the richer and the more varied and the more extreme sometimes the journey, the more pleasure it might give you. The only thing I don't do is that if I am, to use the same analogy, walking through a field and it is damp and misty and cold and I'm not enjoying myself, I will go home. I will not continue reading. So I think that, you know, one has to measure out, you know, balance in your head the value of the book, certainly, and it is good to read great literature, but also the enjoyment, the pleasure of the book is, to my mind, equally important.
So there you go. That was Anthony Horowitz's second castaway choice there. War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, which he hasn't read just yet. Stay tuned for his third and final choice. I'll give you two clues. It's non-fiction and doesn't have a single author.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
This week on the island, we have Emirates Airline Festival of Literature author Anthony Horowitz. It's a real star guest on the island this week. It's very exciting.
I know, I quite want to go and visit the island, have a chat with him.
Yes, it's not like Scaramanga's Island. No, thugs about
to
hurt you.
It's a very welcoming island this week.
We stranded him much in the manner of the Bond and Alex Rider villains he writes so well. If you missed it earlier, here's a glimpse at just how much range Anthony has as a writer.
Anthony Horowitz is one of the most prolific and successful writers working in the UK, juggling writing over 40 books, creating and writing beloved TV series, films, plays, and journalism. Horowitz's bestsellers include the teen spy series Alex Rider. The latest book in the series, Never Say Die, was published last year and will be followed by a short story collection. A TV adaptation is also in the works. Horowitz is also an acclaimed writer for adults. He was commissioned by the Conan Doyle Estate to write two new Sherlock Holmes novels and by the Ian Fleming Estate to write a new James Bond novel. The sequel will be published this spring. In 2014, he was awarded an OBE for his services to literature.
So there you go, that's Anthony Horowitz. That's not really much he hasn't done. And we've had The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer and War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy as his castaway selection so far. And now the non-fiction book with no single author that Anthony chose for his third book. I'll let him tell you about it.
Well, the third book is surprising, I agree, but you know, I did give you a choice of different sorts of books, and I could have chosen the poetry of Philip Larkin, which I could read and reread until, you know, until I was rescued from your desert island, and you know, as I've said, there are great works of literature I could have read, but when I did Desert Island Discs years and years ago, I chose as my book, the one book that I would keep, a dictionary. In that case, it was a dictionary of French, and the idea was that I would learn French, because again, if I'm going to be stuck on the island for a long time, I want to improve myself. Now, for your program, I have chosen a book which I particularly love, which is the Oxford English Dictionary. And I love it because I love words. I love writing. I love literature. I love reading. And it's all made up of these little digits, of which there are millions, and they are words. And if I'm going to sit on your island in the sunshine, I would love to extend my vocabulary and travel and enjoy the sounds, the meanings, the sheer delight of words. Can I give you an example?
Please do.
Before we began this interview, I just opened the dictionary completely at random. Incidentally, wherever I am in the world, because I travel an awful lot, I try to make sure that there is a dictionary nearby, and I do not use the internet, because the internet points you to a single word and maybe gives you how to spell it or when it was created or that sort of thing or what it really means. What it doesn't give you is it the neighbors, the friends of this word that cluster around them. So I opened the dictionary this morning just by chance, and here's the page that I opened was SN, as it turned out, and the first word I saw was Snape. And of course, we all know Severus Snape from J.K. Rowling, but did we know that it was a term associated with shipbuilding, that a Snape is actually a verb to do with sort of cutting the bow of a ship or something? Underneath that, Snaphan, the word I've never come across, meaning a robber or a marauder. And I just love that word, Snaphan. Somehow it makes sense that somebody who robs you should be called a Snaphan. It's also, incidentally, part of a flintlock pistol, so I quite like that. Going down the page to snark, meaning to snore, or to find fault with. Well, we all know snarky. I am occasionally snarky myself. But snark, isn't that a great word? Makes me think of Lewis Carroll as well, the hunting of a snark. From there, underneath there, we get to snarl, a word that everybody knows. But did you know that snarly and snarlish are two words to describe somebody? I know somebody who is snarly, and I just think it's great now that I can actually call them that, and now I'm using a real word. Going on, smash, to abuse. Sneed, the shaft of a scythe. Isn't it wonderful, again, that somebody at some time in history decided that the shaft of a farming implement should have a special word for it? Have you mended my sneed yet? Or a sneck, which is a latch of a door. So look, there we go. That was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, a little journey through 7 words on one page, and I believe that if you get the 20-volume Oxford English Dictionary, there are 59 million words in there for me to enjoy when I'm stuck on your island.
59 million It's hard
that's,
to see.
I picked that up. I must be honest. I picked that up on Wikipedia. and of course, therefore, it may not be true. But it is an incredible thought. I mean, the dictionary that I have in my office, which I'm looking at the moment, is just in two volumes. The shorter Oxford English Dictionary, and that's the page that I was looking at this morning. And that to me is plenty enough. The 20 volume is overdoing it. But you know, I just think that words are much more than what I am saying to you and what we read in books. Words, each word has a character. And as an author, you know, I love the way that words somehow gather themselves together in my head and channel themselves onto the page. And when I'm reading something that I've written, I love the confluence. I love the sort of the sounds they make when they bounce off each other, or the sort of the oxymorons where they seem to have, you know, they seem to have contrary meanings but somehow still make sense. Or, you know, just the fact that there are so many different variations and ways of saying something. Words, even outside fiction or biography or whatever, have a joy in themselves, and so that's why I've chosen this book.
The Oxford English Dictionary for the Love of Words. That seems a perfect note to end your Desert Island book stint on. And I release you because you chose so well.
You're very kind. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
That was Anthony Horowitz there with his third Desert Island book. It was really fun putting him on Castaway.
An excellent interviewee.
There was one bit at the beginning of the interview where he said, because I said I was really surprised that he hadn't chosen Sherlock Holmes or Ian Fleming for his Desert Island. And he said, well, I've taken your challenge very seriously. And he said that if he'd chosen his favourite books, it would have been very different to choosing things that you could reread on a desert island.
Yes, everyone has a very different approach to what they bring to the desert island, don't they? It's really interesting listening each week to see how people do it. His was very, like you say, taken very seriously, and I think he properly saw himself on the desert island, whereas I was just, let's bring my best books along. And then,
because I was just about to ask you, because you've done Castaway.
Yes.
And I remember what you chose. You had Not Now Bernard, Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, and
Neverwhere, was that right?
Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman. So you chose your favourite
books. I just basically pick my favourites and ones that always make me happy, because I thought I might be a bit miserable on my island and I'll need cheering up. I don't think I took it quite as seriously as Anthony Horowitz.
I think it's my favourite part of the segment, though, is the fact that everybody has their different reasons for choosing the books, and that's sometimes even more interesting than the books themselves. So moving on now to some news from the book world.
Book News, your latest literary roundup.
First up, if talking about books with us on Saturday till 1 o'clock today is not enough book chat for you, I have some good news. So the Festival Book Club is meeting this Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. to 8:45 p.m. at the JW Marriott Marquis. There's a 24-hour bakery there. The JW Marriott in Business Bay is called La Farine, and we're meeting there to eat all of the pastries. And more importantly, we're going to talk about a book called Strange Weather by Joe Hill.
One of my favourite books from last year.
And I'm really excited to talk about this because it's a collection of four novellas or short novels. And I heard some really great news recently about there's been a 50% uptake, at least in the UK anyway, of short fiction. So short fiction is getting a bit of a boost now. And I'm really passionate about short fiction, and we were talking the other day about it being actually harder to write.
Yes, in many ways, because you have to get exactly the right words, because you're judged more on the language, I think, arguably, than you are in a longer novel. And so I think it's partly because I read so many kids' books, but I love novellas. They are my book of choice. If there were three books that I wanted to read equally much, I would always pick the novella, just because I prefer that style, and I think you can get much more... I don't know, the plot seems to work better. Everything for me works better in shorter novels, so I'm a big fan.
And one of my favourite books of all time is Roald Dahl's Skin and Other Stories, which is a collection of short stories. Honestly, I do recommend that to anybody. And also, do come along to Strange Weather by Joe Hill, that book club discussion. If you want more details, you can go to emirateslitfest.com, it's all there. Or on Twitter, I talk about it incessantly on Twitter as well.
Also, with those four stories, they're all very different, I think.
Yeah.
So I would defy anybody not to like at least one of them.
There are four stories in there. Three of them have a kind of supernatural element, and one of them absolutely doesn't, and is about the gun crisis in the United States. So if you're interested in that, honestly, it's one of the best things I've ever read about that situation in America.
Yes, one of the most considered things, where you see it from both sides. You see the arguments that I think everyone has their own very clear thought process about that. And it was the first time I questioned some of the things that I thought, and I did think it was very interesting. And he himself said that he'd spoken to people from the... what's it called, the National Rifle
Association.
Association, yeah, the NRA, and got them to say that it was realistic as well. So it's interesting. It's very interesting. It's a good book.
The other thing that happened this week was the poet Jenny Joseph died. She was famous for her I Shall Wear Purple poem. And I thought it might be nice if you read it out, Rachel, if you don't mind.
I would be very happy to. And if anybody knows me, I'm kind of halfway down this road already. So it's always been one of my favourites. Warning. When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple, with a red hat which doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals and say we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bells and run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausages at a go, or only bread and pickle for a week, and hoard pens and pencils and beer mats and things in boxes. But now we must have clothes that keep us dry and pay our rent and not swear in the street and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I ought to practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple.
Rest in peace, Jenny Joseph. In other news, it's Ocean's 11 meets the book world. Valuable books, including a £40,000 first edition of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, have been stolen from a bookshop in Norfolk in the UK. I think as I go through this, you will want there to be a movie made about this. So other titles taken from the bookshop include a signed hardcover first edition of Terry Pratchett's Colour of Magic, worth around £9,000, a first edition of The Hobbit, worth around £7,000. Two men broke into the shop at around midnight on the 8th of January, a set of 4 first editions of Winnie the Pooh, which is quite fitting, seeing as it was Winnie the Pooh Day recently.
They had good taste.
They did. Yeah, they did.
Got some sympathy for their burgling tendency.
Oh, Rachel, I never thought of it that way. A paperback copy of A Brief History of Time with a thumbprint signature by Stephen Hawking were also stolen. Bloomsbury only printed 500 first copies of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, 300 of which went to libraries in 1997. So it's kind of a big deal that it's been stolen.
That's quite an impressive bookshop that had all of these things in stock.
It was called SN Books and it was in Norfolk in the UK.
Wow. A treasure trove.
Kind of like the Fort Knox of first edition.
Well, clearly not, or they wouldn't have.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Not a very good Fort Knox.
No, a Fort Unknox, which is quite fitting, seeing as Knox is one of the spells in Harry Potter.
It's interesting that I wonder if they weren't well protected because of the fact that they were books and people thought they were safer. Because if you had kind of inventory to that value in jewellery or in electronics or something, perhaps it would have been harder to... I don't know enough about the story, but interesting.
I want to make this into a movie.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.